The Science Show on RN, where we stay in space and some of those thrilling images we see all the time of galaxies, stars and planets. Are they real? Meet Robert Hurt, astrophysicist and artist at Caltech.
It's a wonderful study here. It looks more like an art studio. You've got several lovely posters from the journal Nature, beautiful pictures which relate to planets. Did they come from your work here?
Yes, they did. The Nature covers were exciting opportunities to really put exoplanet science on a very visible standing. And it's always that right combination of getting a science result that's interesting enough for Nature to cover, but then also having a visual story that they think really will sell the idea on the cover of the magazine, that you get a chance to do that.
Did you advise on the science there or actually do the artwork yourself?
I did the artwork in consultation with the researchers who actually were responsible for the science results on those. The top one, the planetary hotspot, was a story about one of the so-called hot Jupiters, massive planets that are in these really tight orbits around their star. In this case, a kind of very weird one, where the star was rotating on one axis, but the planet was orbiting almost perpendicular to that. A really cool orientation, something that had not been seen. The planetary suite one you referenced, that was actually really the most exciting exoplanet results to date. A system called TRAPPIST-1, where we had the discovery of seven planets all around the size of Earth, all orbiting a star that itself is only a little bit bigger than Jupiter. And it's about 40 light years away. Several of these planets are in what we would call the habitable zone. So if they have the right conditions, they could potentially have, you know, oceans, liquid water, possibly even the conditions for life. And to find a location with so many Earth-like planets so close and so close into their star is remarkable. And for the cover, we wanted to tell some of that story. So the idea of laying the planets out like them on a tabletop, showing their relative distances to the star, showing water splashed on the table, and hinting at the idea that if the water is too close to the star, it turns into steam, and if it's too far away, it turns to ice. But right in the middle, it still is in its liquid form. It was a way for us to sort of represent this idea of a habitable zone, a range of distances from a star where liquid water might be on terrestrial planets, but do it in a more playful way than just doing it as a diagram with a line or a green bar that delineates that.
You call yourself an astrovisualist, which implies that you're partly scientist and partly artist.
Yes, my formal training is in science, physics, and astronomy, and my lifelong hobby had been art and design, starting initially with the airbrush that my dad had given me in high school, and when I started my first paintings of nebulae and galaxies for the joy of it, transitioned into more digital forms of graphics. You know, it's a lot easier to clean up after painting something in Photoshop than it is when you're using acrylics and an airbrush. Going through a research career and then a science support career, eventually sort of had an intersection of my hobby with my profession. When a lot of my colleagues were interested in getting graphics for press releases and things, I developed a reputation for being good at the art as well as the science. And by the time NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope was preparing to launch in the fall of 2003, we started up a science center here, and I was basically given a job created for me to help tell the science story through the visual side, the graphics.
Of course, people have confessed that the colors are approximate because they can't necessarily show exactly what the colors might be. But you want to have a little bit of artistic license to make it possibly more dramatic. How much do you cleave soundly to the scientific evidence?
This is a very passionate point for me. In fact, for myself and my colleagues who are involved in taking the data from the telescopes and rendering it into the imagery that we see, you know, the Hubble being some of the most famous, but whether it's X-ray data or infrared data from Spitzer, this hideous term that's been around since the 70s, false color, that people bandy about. It was originally coined with all the best intentions, which was to warn people in an era where anytime you saw a color image, there was an expectation it was just a photograph. But the very idea of false color has created this idea that these are somehow not real, like colorizing, like what you would do with a black and white movie when you just sort of arbitrarily paint in color. And that's not really what we do. I prefer to think of it as translating color, taking color from, say, other parts of the spectrum, translating into the red, green, and blue that our eyes can see. You know, if I were to show you an actual photograph, an actual color of an infrared image from the Spitzer Space Telescope, you wouldn't see anything because your eye doesn't work there. But there are real differences from one wavelength to another, the same way that there are differences between green and blue and red. And those relative differences are what defines color. And so if you just pull those from one part of the spectrum and plop them down into the red, green, and blue, you get emergent colors that themselves are real, but representing colors that we can't see using colors that we can.
We've already said goodbye to Kepler on the Science Show. What's the fate of Spitzer?
Well, Spitzer has been really going strongly ever since its launch in 2003 in August. But because it is in its own separate orbit around the Sun, like the Earth, it's been drifting further and further away from the Earth over time. And it's reaching a point where it's getting very, very hard to communicate with it and to communicate it in a way that it can maintain its power levels. So we are now actually entering our final year of operations. And I believe we're scheduled to finally terminate operations on January 30th in 2020. And that'll finish our last science observations, and Spitzer will sort of be given the graceful shutdown command. Given that this was a mission that I think at launch no one really imagined was ever going to go past, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, it's a testimony to just how clever engineers and scientists can be, reimagining how an observatory works, figuring out that things that you thought were conditions that you couldn't operate under, you could if you overrode certain things or reimagined how the hardware should operate.
What will you do to terminate its life?
Well, I think there'll be some event that we'll schedule. We'll probably be up at the Jet Propulsion Lab. We may have a little ceremonial transmission of the final instructions to the spacecraft. I'm sure we'll have a party for everybody who's ever worked on it ever since then. You know, it's always a bittersweet opportunity. You know, if you saw what happened with, say, Cassini when it had its grand finale, you've got people who were working on this for most of their professional careers. You're very proud of everything that had happened to that point, but you're sad. It's like losing a relative or a loved one. I'm sure there will be tears.
Robert Hurt of the IPAC Center at Caltech Pasadena on the artistic side of astrophysics and the intrepid nature of technology never giving up.